The Panama Papers trove is, by sheer volume of documents, the largest whistleblower leak in history. With more than 100 news organizations from more than 80 countries involved, it's also the largest journalistic collaboration ever. And it has already claimed its first scalp.
The Icelandic Prime Minister, Mr. Gunnlaugsson, has now stood down.
He's accused of hiding millions of dollars in investments behind a secretive offshore company.
The context to all of this is the financial crash in 2008. Some of the failed banks here were using shell companies in offshore havens, and what happened nearly brought down this economy.
But the 11.5 million documents from the Panama law firm Mossack Fonseca also expose shadowy dealings surrounding dictators and kleptocrats worldwide. Most notably so far, Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, Bashar al-Assad of Syria, and Vladimir Putin, with 99% of the iceberg still submerged. The material has been scrutinized by some 400 reporters for the past year under the coordination of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Gerard Ryle is the consortium's director. Gerard, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
This massive story began with a single encrypted chat message sent a year ago to Bastian Obermeier at the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung. It said, quote, "Hello, this is John Doe, interested in data," and thus commenced a very complex endeavor. What happened next?
Well, Bastian picked up the phone and he rang me once he'd realized that the names he was looking at went to several different countries, and he proposed that we really should do this as an international collaboration. A few days later, I found myself on a plane to Munich. We spent about 4 days looking through the documents and convincing ourselves that we were onto something very large. And from there, I started collecting the partners that would end up working with us. I immediately went to London, where I talked to the BBC and the Guardian newspaper, and I had a sample of documents with me. I showed the reporters the documents, and they had the same opinion.
How long did it take before you actually had reporters looking at documents in search of misfeasance?
Actually, at that point, it took several months to make the documents readable because they came in different formats. You had spreadsheets, you had passport details, you had PDFs. In fact, a lot of the documents you couldn't even read. And so we had to spend a lot of time using optical character recognition to scan them into a searchable database. But after a few months of work, they were all readable, certainly the amount of documents that we had at that point. And then we started bringing in more reporters because we could see at that point that there are even more countries involved. So we started reaching out to other media partners.
Now, even with 400 reporters, 11 million documents is a lot of material to sort through, which means you couldn't just merely hand the equivalent of cartons full of documents to people and ask them to just start picking through it. There had to be a more systematic way of going about finding relevant names of individuals and companies. You actually built a proprietary search engine in order to accomplish this?
Yes, we just used open software. Our data engineers built a search engine so that reporters could search from their own laptops. So we literally piped all the material down over the internet into the newsrooms using encrypted technology, and then they could log into the search system and search for names themselves. And parallel to that, we also built a virtual newsroom where we asked the reporters, when they went into their physical newsrooms every day, to also log on to the ICIJ, what we called the iHub, which was our virtual newsroom. And so they could go on there and communicate with the other reporters. And it was built a bit like Facebook, where as soon as they found something interesting in the documents, they immediately posted what they found, and they could start groups if someone was interested, for instance, in drug dealers or diamond dealers or say a country like Iceland or Brazil. They could form their own groups and then have chats and searches and links to documents and other findings in there. And also in that virtual newsroom, we went outside the documents because if there was a court case we needed to find or a court document, you could go to the country, get the document, and also upload it and link it. And so you had this amazing, almost library of information that was building as the collaboration continued.
So did the reporters from any given country just go through the search engine and type in the names of their usual suspects, their politicians and tycoons.
Well, I think every reporter started doing that. Of course, you know, that's what I did when I first started looking at the documents. But over time, you realize that, first of all, you weren't getting the hits you wanted. You weren't getting the magic names that you would be the best possible stories. So then you learned that you needed to basically go where the documents brought you, and you needed to search in different ways. I remember at one point we had a big breakthrough when one of the Swiss reporters found a way of searching passport details. So you could literally type in a code and every American passport would pop up. So of course, if you were an American reporter looking at this, that was a great place to start because you wanted to have a look at your own citizens. And from there, you went outside the documents when you found interesting people, people that had been convicted of crimes, or in some countries there were politicians. But the other big advantage of working in this way is that we had what I would call native reporters looking at native names. So the Brazilians were looking at the Brazilian names, the Icelandic reporter was looking at the Icelandic names. And so you're very quickly able to establish if someone was a politician or a public official, someone of public interest.
Of course, the whole point of going to offshore locations to create shell corporations is to avoid scrutiny. So, you know, it's not as though you type in Vladimir Putin and you hit all of his accounts in Panama and elsewhere. You discovered in his case that the dealings centered on not the chairman of Gazprom and not any other obvious oligarch, but of course, a classical cellist.
Well, this is a man called Sergei Roldugin. He has gone on the record to the New York Times in the past as saying that he is nothing but a cellist. He's not a businessman. He doesn't have money, essentially. But in these documents, we found this cellist was actually the owner of a number of offshore companies. And those offshore companies were getting very large bank loans from a state bank in Russia. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. And there were some questions that we could ask about the transactions. I mean, some of these loans were basically being assigned to companies for the princely sum of $1. And we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, Sergei is actually the godfather of Putin's child. And we also then followed that trail until we found another offshore company that was the owner of a ski resort in Russia, apparently Putin's favorite ski resort, but also the place where his other daughter got married. And so we're able to suddenly find things that were secret until then. And that allowed us to build a bigger picture on that particular story. And of course, in the virtual newsroom, a group popped up called Russia and Putin. And then all the reporters who were interested in that piled in. And all these eyes started looking at the documents and more things fell out.
The Panama Papers already in the first couple of days have yielded a lot of big names like Putin, like Assad. Is this the cream and everything to follow just skim milk? Or as you sift through more and more mountains of data, can we expect other high-profile money launderers and thieves and tax cheats and so on to emerge?
I would hope that after a year of looking at this with hundreds of journalists around the world, that we have actually found at least most of the cream. But I do think there'll be fallout. We have more stories planned. And of course, all of the media partners we worked with, which were more than 100, they've got their own schedules as well. So we think the stories will continue to run out for weeks. And eventually, of course, we hope to publish more of the documents, which should in themselves actually trigger more stories. We're already seeing that for the limited amount of information that we did release. We're already seeing new stories emerge that we weren't aware of that were in there.
Since you're not going to release the documents to the public en masse to crowdsource them, do these news organizations have an ongoing commitment to stay on this?
I think you'll find that the news organizations that we got involved will stay with the story. I mean, I think it's important to distinguish, though, between just publishing everything and publishing what is in the public interest. I think one of the things we're trying to do as journalists is actually reclaim that ground that I think was lost to organizations like WikiLeaks. And I'm in no way criticizing WikiLeaks. So what they do is fair as far as I'm concerned. It's just that I don't necessarily think that journalists should be doing that. I think journalists should apply journalistic ethics and journalistic practice to these kind of documents, which is why you're seeing so many politicians, by the way, in the first few days, because there's no argument that these people are of public interest. They're elected to office. And what we've found is that some of them didn't tell the public that they had these holdings offshore. And I think that is of genuine public interest, and no one can really argue.
Is the sheer volume of this evidence that Mossack Fonseca in Panama kind of has cornered the market on shell entities, or that the iceberg that the early stories have been a tip of is just the tip of a much larger iceberg?
Well, there's no doubt that we're only looking at a small amount of the offshore world. Mossack Fonseca is one of the top five registers of offshore companies in the world. So we know it's one of the largest firms. But we also know from previous reporting and from this reporting that there are about 800 other firms out there doing exactly the same thing. They're unusual in that they're in so many different jurisdictions. They're here in the US. They had two offices here. And they're in China, they're in New Zealand, they're in England, they're everywhere. And that's what made them interesting. You know, even though we call this the Panama Papers, by no means was it all coming out of Panama. All of the offshore companies that were being set up all over the world. And I should add, were being set up on behalf of major banks and institutions and accountancy firms and law firms around the world, including many here in the US.
And most of it, however sleazy, is nonetheless legal. The whole point is to find legal avenues for camouflaging sometimes illegally gotten gains.
Yes. I mean, it is not illegal by itself to go and register an offshore company. In fact, it happens all the time. But what we were looking at was a lot of illegality and a lot of things that you would have to say are very questionable. When we went to Mossack Fonseca for comment, they responded that, in fact, a lot of the people we were looking at, a lot of the end users of these companies, were not, in fact, their clients. That's what they argued. They argued that, in fact, the client was the bank. And if the bank came to them looking to set up an offshore account for one of the bank customers, then they took no responsibility for finding out who that person really was. So that's why we found in the data things like, if you typed in the word Pyongyang into our search system, you found a company that was registered in the capital of North Korea. Now, that would normally send alarm bells out, you would have thought. And sure enough, when you go outside the data and you look at the international sanctions list, there was that company. And they hadn't stopped to ask who their end customer was. It was actually the North Korean state, which seems incredible.
Sadly, not to me. Have you, or has Süddeutsche Zeitung heard from other whistleblowers as a direct result of the attention paid to the Panama Papers?
I'm not sure whether they've been contacted by anybody new, but you do touch on a very good point. I do think that technology today really allows this kind of radical transparency, because whoever gathered this material did so in a way that wouldn't have been possible 5 or 10 years ago. So, you know, what we're seeing, and I guess what we're in the era of now, is the era of huge leaks, huge data gathering potential and huge data gathering leaking that's going on. I mean, it's not that difficult, believe it or not, to gather this much material now. We had every email and every document going back to 1977 in this leak. That's what's possible. And I think this is the largest leak in history, but in probably 2 or 3 years' time, we'll be talking about something twice or three times the size.
Yeah, Gerard, I have some good news for you and I have some bad news for you. The good news is that, as you expected, the Panama Papers have captured the attention of the media throughout the world, except two places. One is China, which has this great firewall. And the other is the United States of America. You barely made it to the front page in any of the major newspapers. To what can you possibly attribute the crickets in the U.S. that met your big scoops?
I was told this when I first came to America, and I didn't believe it, that if you're not working with the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or 60 Minutes or NPR, then it doesn't matter. And I think, unfortunately, that's what we're up against. But as the reporting has come out and things have actually started to catch fire, we're now finding our way onto the front pages. And in fact, I think the public editor at the New York Times had to write a column defending why the New York Times didn't run this on the front page on day one. They put it on page 3. But I was quite heartened to see that newspapers like USA Today, though, they splashed with it. They just thought, okay, this is a great news story. Let's remake the front page and go for it.
Did you go to them and did they send you packing?
We did not go to the New York Times with this project, but we have approached them in the past to collaborate, and it hasn't worked out. A polite way of putting it. I think, you know, my theory on that is that really the biggest news outlets in America still think that they're big enough on their own, whereas the rest of the world has now realized that the financial models that have sustained our journalism in the past are actually broken, and they're more willing to look at new ways of doing things, whereas the big American outlets, and I'm really restricting them to the New York Times and maybe the big four that I mentioned, they think that they don't need to collaborate. And I do think that they just haven't caught up with the real world yet, and eventually they will.
Gerard, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Gerard Ryle is the director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, which coordinated the Panama Papers. This has been an On the Media Podcast Extra. I'm Bob Garfield.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.